Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Advanced cancer imaging, a smarter MRI, a mobile eye exam, and a child-resistant spray bottle. Those are four OSU student-designed innovations competing for a $10,000 prize. They've gone up against a dozen other healthcare products in a competition aimed at improving patients' lives. And when a winner is crowned, he or she can lay claim to the first official Big Idea in Health. Joining us to tell us more about these finalists and the Big Ideas in Health program is Chief Innovation Officer, Director for the Center for Critical Care at OSU, Dr. Clay Marsh. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
So the Big Ideas Forum final round will be held on Friday. It's open to the public. Our listeners can check the website for more information and to register for that. Tell us a little bit about the contest in general. The way it's been described to me is something like a kinder, gentler version of the TV show Shark Tank.
Yes, indeed. It's quite a bit of fun. Just to make sure that people out there know, if they want to attend, that the final competition is Friday, May 30th from 8 to 9:30 in the Prior Health Science Library on the sixth floor. And certainly people can apply to attend at the ideastudio.osu.edu. And this is an opportunity for us to try to celebrate the smart, creative people in our community who have important and great ideas that can help others and really to meet our brand promise of improving people's lives.
Why aren't they just going out and putting these ideas forth themselves? What does this do to help that process?
That's an important question. And what we've really focused on doing is not only recruiting the people with the best ideas, and you outlined the four finalists, which are very exciting and have gone through a fairly rigorous competition, but it's really trying to create an environment, a networking opportunity for them to meet the people in our community and beyond who can help them move these products and ideas and solutions to the people that need them.
Because the judges aren't just medical professionals, they include business people.
Absolutely. We have judges that include entrepreneurs, venture capital people, people that run companies. And so the idea that we have put forward is that they, as an entity, will not only sort of in a kinder and gentler way, as you suggest, be a kind of a Shark Tank group, but that we also use them to mentor the people that are competing, both the people that win and the people that don't, to see if we can help those people move the ideas forward.
My guest is Dr. Clay Marsh. He's director for the Center for Critical Care at OSU. We're talking about the Big Ideas Forum final round. We're going to get to talking more about some of the finalists in this contest. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So there are four final products, and they're pretty different from each other. So how do you judge a winner when you're comparing apples and oranges?
Well, we take into account the presentation of the presenter and their business model. They present a very modified and simplified business plan. They demonstrate the need for this product or service in the community. And we look at the ability to deliver that and whether or not there is a lot of other solutions like it in that particular field. So for the four that we've chosen, you're right, they're quite varied. But we felt that the four ideas really, the child-resistant spray bottle gave us an opportunity to protect children. And this is a person who works at Children's Hospital. The MRI optimization is really about trying to create a template that we can do scans much faster and much more accurately.
Typically, they take how long now?
Take probably, depending on what you're doing, between 15 and 40 minutes. And so by doing things faster, it's not only good for an organization because you get many more studies in the same amount of time, which mm-hmm. equals more money, more efficiency, but for the person getting the scan as a person who has gotten an MRI before, the faster that thing's over, the more that I liked it because it's very, very closed environment.
And you have to stay very still.
You do. So it's nice to have an opportunity to get a more accurate reading that could be done much faster. And then when we look at the eye mobile exam, this is a solution using an iPad where you can get an automated eye exam. And it turns out that that could be paired with an automatic way to make glasses because, as I understand it, the most important reason why people have vision problems internationally is because they don't have the right refraction. They don't have glasses to help them see. And this could be a solution that doesn't require a person to do. It could be automated. And then lastly, the electromagnetic detection of cancer is a way that we might be able to scan a tissue and show a surgeon what is the range of the cancer in that tissue so that when you resect that area, you could make sure you get all the cancer out. And you could do that real time.
And that's pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, it's very cool. And what's great about it is almost all the inventors we've had, not only these winners, but also people that have competed, have all been motivated because they want to make a difference. They want to truly deliver something that matters to the people that need it. So the motivation here is really quite inspiring. And you really get that when you come to the competition.
Sometimes those competitions, you know, the talent competitions and stuff, it ends up being the runner-up who ends up being the most famous, ends up being the winner in the long run. Jennifer Hudson, for example. Just because you don't win this, the exposure must be good no matter what.
Yeah, we talk a lot that it's not really about winning and losing. It's really about participating and putting your idea out there in front of people that can help make it go forward and can give you mentorship and advice and connect you to the right people. And that's truly our motivation for doing this. And the kind of the competition adds a little bit of fun factor to it, and it keeps it interesting, I think, for the audience and does put some pressure on the presenters to do a really good job.
Do you have to be a student, did you say?
No, these are people. In fact, these are all people that are faculty members in different places. So we
it's
have
OSU, though.
We have OSU. We have one of the people, Lara McKenzie, who did the child-resistant spray bottle, is actually at Nationwide Children's Hospital as her employer. But we are very much focused on OSU types of technologies, but we also open it up to people in the community because we want the best ideas to go forward, and we want to have people with solutions to be able to deliver those.
And then there's this kind of fuzzy concept of improving patients' lives. There's that at the base of all of this, at the core of it all.
Absolutely true. So that's our brand promise to our customers. And I'm a big fan of TED Talks and Simon Sinek, his video, The Golden Circle, where instead of starting with what and then how and then why, we try to start with why. Why are we here? What are we trying to accomplish? And everything we do should really be focused in improving people's lives in meaningful ways.
Yeah, the idea of, you know, what you do, you're director for the Center for Critical Care at OSU, but you're also the Chief Innovation Officer. And that's a pretty big title.
It is.
And you choose to, or at least in this case, see it through the lens of the patient.
Absolutely. And I think that for us, the really meaningful opportunity here is how do we start to think about medicine differently, medicine of the future? And my take on it, and I think our organizational take, is that currently our brand and our model is rescue from failure. So we basically wait till people get sick and we try to apply technologies and precision treatments to help people get better. My real interest and goal is how do we prevent people from getting sick, and how do we do that in ways that's not just about immunizations, which are important, or about, you know, about exercising enough, but really starting to think about how do we start to approach health from a very precise level, and how do we understand that? And that to me is quite interesting.
Now, this contest, the Big Ideas Forum, or the Big Ideas Contest, is part of a larger operation. It's called the Ideas Studio. Tell us about that.
So the Ideas Studio, which is a name that we sort of came up with, stands for I Innovation, DE Design, and A Application, which is really about delivery of things to people. And our goal is to do two things, really. So the first one is to create this concept of P4 medicine, which we've worked on for a good amount of time.
And we've talked about that before
we
on
have.
The show.
And P4 stands for predictive, preventive, personalized, and participatory medicine, which is really how do we prevent failure. And the other part is how do we then take the best ideas from Ohio State and put those in the hands of people that can use them. So this idea about innovation and commercialization. And we want the right partners to do that. And so in the Idea Studio, we really have four foundational programs that are going on now. So the first one we talked about, which is really about innovation and commercialization, which involves the big ideas, involves putting these ideas into real products and services and delivering those to people. The second one is we're working now with New Albany, Ohio, to try to facilitate having them be a very healthy city. And the idea here, or the concept, is that we are focused on how do we slow down aging and how do we start to bend the environment so that it makes living well normal.
Give me an example of that.
So we're really interested, as one example, so we know today that there's a lot of talk about the role of sugar, refined sugar and added sugar to foods as a health problem in this country. Mm-hmm. And Fed Up, which is the new movie by Lori David and moderated by Katie Couric, is a movie about that. And people that I've gotten to know are very much experts in this particular area. So if we believe that sugar is really an important problem for our population, and there's lots of data that maybe sugar is at the root of some of the diseases that we're seeing come up more, including cancer, and we believe maybe even causing you to age faster, then we have created a labeling system that then identifies foods that, as presented, would meet the very strict standards of low sugar and the right nutritional components. So by trying to create this labeling system, we can navigate people very easily and quickly, and we call it the Healthy Buckeye Approved label. We can navigate people quickly to food that might be better for them, as one example.
Going into a place like New Albany is one thing. Applying this kind of an approach to medicine is another thing when you're talking about, say, urban areas, inner cities, that kind of a thing. More of a challenge.
Yeah, for sure. But I think that, you know, it's the Chinese proverb that the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. And I have to say, for me, that I've been very blessed in my life, and I've been blessed with great opportunities professionally, personally, family. But I see the bigger opportunity here to try to work collaboratively to understand what are those important moves that we could do that could really make a difference. And if you look at nature, we know that only a few things really matter. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out what is the opportunity that we have to be able to measure and truly improve the health of our population. And it's interesting that Google has gotten into this game, and they started a company, Larry Page did, called Calico. And Calico's aim is to improve the health of our world, and they're doing it by focusing on longevity. So they're trying to figure out how we can slow aging down. And that's indeed what we're trying to do too. So,
well, Dr. Clay Marsh, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Yeah, my pleasure. And it's wonderful work you're doing, and we're really very pleased to be in the position where we can truly improve people's lives.
Dr. Clay Marsh, he is the Chief Innovation Officer and Director for the Center for Critical Care at OSU. Wellness Wednesday will continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the U.S. each year, about 1.6 million people are diagnosed with cancer, and each of them has a story. Humorist Pat Wynn Brown was inspired to tell her own story through humor. In recent years, she has helped others tell theirs through her Hair Theater productions. Last year, she produced The Hair Monologues, When Monsieur Chemo Styles Her Hair. It's a series of monologues written and performed by cancer survivors and others involved in the story of cancer. The video of the show premieres tonight at the Lincoln Theater. You can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides for details. Joining us now to tell us more is Hair Theater creator Pat Wynn Brown. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Anne. Good morning.
This is pretty exciting.
It's very exciting tonight to be able to share this video. And it's a 36-minute highlight reel of the Hairdo Monologues project and show that we did a year ago, February, and you were at the show. Mm-hmm. But we had 400 people. It was a sold-out night. And we had to turn people away. So at the end of the show, I decided we need to get this out to others. And I went on Kickstarter and did a campaign, and Alan Beavers, the videographer, joined me, and we put together the highlights of the project and show. We'll show that tonight, but we'll also have some entertainment from the Men in Black, from the Marion Franklin Community Center, line dancers ages 59 to 89. Nicole Lindsay, a former river dancer, will be dancing. The cast of the show will be there, and three of my young dudes will be there from the Dude Wears My Hair show, and you know about my dudes.
I love that show.
I love all the shows. Thank you.
I love all of them. They're all incredibly entertaining and funny.
Yes.
In a way that brings you to tears on several levels.
Yes.
I think what I liked about the Hair Monologues the most was the fact that you made more of a mosaic of it. They're all mosaics, but you incorporated not just people who are cancer survivors, but the people who work with people who have cancer.
Yes, we included the physicians, Dr. Mary Pat Borges and Dr. Mark Kreib.
Right.
And they told their own hair stories,
yeah,
because everybody has hair stories. And really, hair for me is just a metaphor. It's my water lilies. We start with hair, but it's about our hopes and dreams. And when we're diagnosed with a terrible disease or go through a crisis, our dreams crumble and they become ashes. And my whole point with all of the Hair Theater episodes is from the ashes come new dreams. And that's what tonight is about. It's not depressing. It won't leave you thinking, oh, those poor people. When you tell your story, you become the star of your own script and no longer a victim. And it empowers you. And it makes you stronger mentally and physically. And it affects your immune system.
Right. I mean, telling stories or telling a story using that narrative tool is part of part of the healing process.
It is. And the shamans in ancient medicine, the ancient medical, you know, witch doctors would ask the patient, when did you stop singing? When did you stop dancing? And when did stories stop being enchanting to you? And that has a lot to do with the loss of spirit. So when we talk about mind, body, and spirit, when you tell your story, you start to bring your spirit back. And I saw that with the cast members, and I saw that with the physicians who did not necessarily lose their spirit. But when you deal with people who are very ill day to day, that can really take its toll on you. So for them to be able to tell their story of what that's like to nurture someone who's going through this, and also the hair professionals involved who, when a woman comes in and says, I need for you to shave my head, I'm going to be going through chemo and I don't want to watch my hair fall out on my pillow, they are left with a big responsibility to help that person through that phase of life. So when we do just the separate workshops, the Hairdo Monologue workshops, where we just tell the stories at lunchtime, it's not in a big show at the mm-hmm. end, I often have hairdressers there because this is a part of training that they really need, because they're going to be seeing it more and more where women come in and they even have hair shaving parties and bring in their friends to make this a ritual, to make it a celebration of them. So with the arts, with the dancing, with the singing, and we're all going to sing at the end of the show, and I'm going to play my ukulele badly because I know the same three chords as Eric Clapton. You know, we all know the same three chords. It's all it takes to be in show business. We will have fun tonight.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Pat Wynn Brown. She is the creator of Hair Theater. We are talking about the premiere show of the video of highlights from Hair Theater, Hair Monologues, when Monsieur Chemo does your hair.
Yes, and you're in that DVD, and I have to say that this is our this is our hometown premiere, but I did premiere it initially in Paris at the American Church of to their women's group, and then I took it to Key West and showed it to physicians and cancer survivors and nurses there. And recently it played at the Irma Bombeck Conference, the humor conference, and Irma Bombeck's daughter, Betsy, was there. And Irma was a breast cancer survivor. Mm-hmm. She had complications from a kidney transplant later. But it was wonderful to have her there to see the video as well. And tonight's performance is free.
That's another thing about this particular show, is that it has legs. Mm-hmm. It was a start of something. It wasn't the end of something. It was the start of this whole narrative the use of the narrative in medicine and how there's more people out there.
Yes, with narrative medicine, you know, they're teaching it at Columbia in the medical school, and I'm finding more and more articles to support this, that when physicians ask the patient for the story of what has happened to them, it is a stronger diagnosis. It is a shorter hospital stay. There's less chance of coming back to the hospital. Your immunities are raised. Your blood pressure goes down. I mean, these are all proven things about the narrative medicine. And I think the cast members found this to be true, because Vicky had been newly diagnosed when we started this show, and then went through a very tough time with treatment. And Tony, her husband, is in the show as well. But that night, she said of the show, it was the first time she had slept in almost a year, because she was able to share this with the audience. So we're able to help ourselves telling our stories, but the people in the audience that night came up and said, I'm not going through cancer. I was here just to support my friend, and I thought this would be so sad, but, you know, I am going through this with my adult child, and it helped me. It helped me to understand the strength of the human spirit to endure unbelievable sadness. And we can find happiness and joy even in the midst of all the storms. Wendy says in her monologue, we need to learn to dance in the rain. So tonight for the show, this is a very good message for a rainy day in Columbus.
A very rainy day coming up. If you have a question or comment for Pat Wynn Brown, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. With the DVD now, it's a lot easier for people to see these highlights of the show. But for those who can't easily participate in narrative theater, what can they do to get involved in the story of illness and recovery?
They can do this themselves. And if they have a friend, they can talk to their friend about what's happening with them and say to the friend, I just need to get this out. They can journal. They can make collages. They can commune with nature. Or they can sing or dance. Singing and dancing does help you to feel better, to tell your story through your own voice. And my contention is, you don't have to be a great singer or a great dancer to do those things, because I make a living doing it, and I am subpar.
That is not true. Now, everyone wants to tell, not everyone, I should say, wants to tell a story.
No.
Not everyone has the personality for it. We're not all in that position. What about the patients or family members who find it too painful to share?
You know, sometimes there's shame involved with our story, and or so much pain that we cannot bear to tell the story. What helps is to listen to other people's stories, and WOSU helps us to do that. Because when I listen to the TED Talks, when I listen to The Moth, when I listen to This American Life, and I hear other people's stories, when we hear somebody's story, whether we have done those things or not, because it's the human condition, we resonate with that. So it can be some passive narrative medicine going on by just turning on your radio on Saturday afternoon. I guarantee you'll feel better.
Listening to other people's stories.
Listen to other people's stories.
Ohio Health's logo appears on all of this. Tell us about their role in the presentation.
They have been wonderfully supportive. Leslie Steele started this with Ohio Health Physicians, had me go to a meeting, and they, at first, the surgeons were very leery about this. My proposal, my dream for having the project and show was met with silence. And then they were worried, and they said, oh, this is going to be so sad, and it's so painful for women to talk about their hair. The hair is almost sometimes the worst part. But after months of digesting this, and because of Dr. Mark Kripe, who said, I've been to her show, I know she can handle this. So he was my knight in shining armor. And then they teamed me up with Pauline Russ, who's my liaison, and I discovered she's a cancer survivor. She had breast cancer when she was pregnant with her child, but she was also the manager of breast health. So she came on board, and together for the project and the show, and then for tonight at Lincoln Theater, Ohio Health has supported this because they understand how narrative medicine needs to come into play with the treatment of patients.
Are physicians using this? Are they plugging into this?
They are. In fact, I was just talking to a woman in the waiting room who said that she was observing the younger physicians doing this in a situation, and she said it is coming into play. They are teaching it at Columbia, and it's a little bit different. It takes more time, and it takes some real compassion, true empathy, which our physicians have. I'm a cancer survivor. I've had wonderful physicians. But both of my surgeons, both of my oncology surgeons, Dr. Walker at the James, Dr. Kripe, who was at Grant, both of them were listeners. And it does help you to go through this. And I have to tell you, I'm a crier. Both times I was diagnosed, I cried. One of my little dudes said, courage is not the absence of fear. Seth Jenkins said that. So I let my fears show. And both of those men were so kind to me in their respective ways. They're very different men. But that listening to me and letting me tell what I was so worried about, even though it was probably not going to happen, helped me to get through those surgeries. It really did.
There is, as you know, a lot of humor in the show, mm-hmm. which I think surprises people, you know, as you mentioned. But the humor, it's in the telling of the story, too.
It's in the telling, and
it's not like jokes.
It's not jokes, and I'm not a comedian. I can't even tell a
joke.
You're
a humorist.
I'm a humorist.
Right.
And humor is a combination of comedy and tragedy. And Jackie Gleason, the old comedian, used to say, if I've made an audience laugh and cry, I've done my job. And that's how I feel about it. It's a beautiful cocktail, laughter and tears. It's the best cocktail ever.
So what do you think going forward about the future of Hair Monologues?
Yeah, I think with Hairdo Monologues,
we talked about Cruz.
That'd be a great thing. Doing the Hairdo Monologues on the Buckeye Cruise for Cancer, that would be like the coolest thing. And it would work so well and put on a show.
Sure,
it would be wonderful.
Exactly.
But I think that when I've done these groups that are on a Saturday afternoon from 9 to 2 type of thing, and then they share their stories, it has made such a difference with every person there. And there are some techniques to helping the people tell and write their story that I do know how to do. Mm-hmm. And that does take a little bit of extra skill. You can't just plop this into every healthcare system and have it work. It does take some doing to have people want to tell their story. I mean, we had most of the actors in the cast were reluctant to be in the show. Oh, I can't get up in front of people. I couldn't possibly do that. I don't want to do. Oh, no, I'm scared to death. Oh, we trained. We wrote their stories. We revised their stories. They learned how to be on the stage. And they became stars. I'm so proud of all 12 of them. And I'm proud of my three dudes who are coming tonight to offer words of wisdom, the young people who are in that show. Harrison, Corinne, and Noah will be there. And we had our rehearsal during the tornado sirens last week. So they're very brave kids.
email asking if there is a fee for tonight's show?
It is absolutely free. And Ohio Health and Pauline Russ were so smart. We had to close people out of the live show last time because we could only seat 400, but we're at the Lincoln that seats 580. So I say to you, just come to the show. Just come to the show. You will get in.
For more information, you can go to the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Has everything you need to know there. Pat, you've been learning about talking about this for years now.
Since 2000, I wrote my first hair theater show, and it's a variety of episodes, and not all of them are about cancer, you know.
Right.
I have Hair Theater Beauty School, which is what is true beauty at any age, and there's the Catholic schoolgirl hair follicles that are Lady of Perpetually Glorious Hairdos High. There's a heart health hair theater.
But it all began with your issue with how you started to see hair as the metaphor when you thought you might lose yours from chemo.
Actually, it didn't.
Oh, okay.
It was more of, I was watching my hairdresser.
Okay.
And everybody told the hairdresser everything. I mean, everything.
That's right.
So it started with that. And then I started doing these shows because I did make a bargain with God, you know, let me live and I'll do something good. And I saw how it lifted people's spirits. And then I thought, I can do a cancer survivor hair theater, too. So there are about 12 different hair theater shows floating around.
And you travel all over the country doing this.
I do. And internationally to Paris.
Of course, that's right. Paris. How could I forget?
Yes. And they loved it. They loved it. And there you were laughing in the DVD with the Seine just outside the window. How great is that?
That's maybe as close as I'll ever get to Paris, but I'll take what I could get. Pat Wynn Brown, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this again. Best wishes for every success with the Hair Monologues.
Thank you. Tonight we'll see the beauty in the middle of the morass of misery.
That's Pat Wynn Brown, creator of Hair Theater, and you can learn more about the Hair Monologues when Monsieur Chemo does your hair. Tonight is at the Lincoln Theater. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Center for Disease Control estimates that 1 in 4 women will be abused by a partner in her lifetime. This type of abuse can result in chronic pain, insomnia, and post-traumatic stress disorder, but the physical breaks and bruises are what usually drive victims to the emergency room. Joining us in the studio to talk about the physician response to domestic violence is residency director in the Department of Emergency Medicine at OSU, Dr. Diane Gorgas. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
You wrote about this issue recently in your column in the Columbus Dispatch. It was the patient you'll never forget.
Unfortunately, I was able to choose from one of many patients I'll never forget. These are patients that we tend to have multiple contact points with throughout the years or a career in emergency medicine. And in a very frustrating sense, they're some of the patients that have the highest rate of return visits to the emergency department and that we seem to have the least ability to impact and change their lives.
So you see these people often over the course of a career. Are there lots of them?
Again, unfortunately, I think that there are many more of them than we are able to identify. So there are the clear-cut cases, patterns of abuse, patterns of violence that tell a story just by the type of injuries that they present with. A newly pregnant patient that comes in with bruising across her lower back or across her lower abdomen. That's almost pathognomonic for domestic partner abuse or intimate partner abuse. There are some defensive injuries that we see that we can identify from a football field away as these patients being victims of domestic violence. But there are a lot of more subtle types of injuries that aren't initially identified on first presentation.
So, such as?
And the push, the slap across the face. There are many, many mechanisms that can cause broken bones. And frequently, if a patient confabulates a story and sticks to that story, sometimes in the sake of their own self-protection, we can't identify that initially.
There's a questionnaire that you run through that that includes a question about, were you harmed by somebody else?
Correct. The way that it's usually stated is, do you feel safe with your partner?
Okay. So it doesn't mean you're blaming somebody in that moment. It's less direct.
Yes. Or do you feel safe in your home environment? It is a screening question. The question that we have as medical professionals is, where do you go with that information? And is that the right screening question to ask? Is it the right environment in which to ask it? And are there other barriers that women feel when they come in to be treated, or any partner of domestic violence? This can happen to men as well.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other barriers that we can eliminate so that they feel more comfortable reporting and more comfortable in seeking resources?
And then when you are working with or you're treating a victim of domestic violence of some stripe, do you ask them, do you have children?
I frequently ask about the entire home situation. I ask if they have children. I ask if they have family. I ask if they have any extended friends that can act as safe havens for them.
Mm-hmm.
Frequently, it's not safe for my patients to go back to their living environment. Frequently, it's not safe for them to, or they don't feel comfortable seeking help from friends or family because they know that their intimate partner may seek them out at these locations.
Mm-hmm.
And often it's not safe for them to go to a shelter either, or it's undesirable for them to go to a shelter. The one case that I wrote about, Donna, the first time that she left her home with her child, gathered a few of her essential belongings, she left a dog behind, and when she came back, her husband had killed the dog.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday segment with Dr. Diane Gorgas. She's residency director in the Department of Emergency Medicine at OSU Medical Center. If you have a question or comment about this, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Have you been a victim of domestic violence? Have gone to the emergency room? Tell us about your experience there and maybe how an emergency room physician or nurse could help you work through these issues. 614-292-8513. Kind of the impetus or the emotional impetus for me when I was reading the column came from the fact that you don't get to see these people as a follow-up physician as a rule.
Right. We don't get to see these patients as a rule. There are it's a new day and age in medicine compared to when I initially trained in medical school, and truly people were lost to the winds. Now we have electronic medical records. At least within system, if somebody has another touch point at OSU Wexner Medical Center, I can find out about it. But this, by definition, is a patient population that is relatively transient and not likely to have the stability to return to one hospital repeatedly. And we do lose patients because of that. Even if I give them my home phone number and tell them to call me at any time, there are lots of barriers, including a woman's sense of her own personal safety for doing that.
What do you do? What is your obligation when you suspect that someone is being abused?
I'm so glad you ask. The laws for intimate partner violence are distinctly different for those for elder abuse or as compared to those for child abuse. We can only report with the permission of the victim, of the permission of the patient that presents to the emergency department. the way that the Ohio law is written is specifically designed to protect the patient if they believe that reporting may cause worsening of their situation at home. So we can encourage people to report, and we do encourage people to report. We encourage them to at least file a police report, even if they decide not to press charges, so that evidence can be gathered at the time of their presentation. But it's not something that we can mandate. And it's frankly unsafe for these women for us to go outside of those prescriptive limits to pick up the phone and call police.
Deb in Sunbury, you're on the air. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I have been to the hospital a couple of times in the last 6 months for a blood pressure issue. And when I was in the triage part, my husband came with me because he was, concerned for me, and he was with me. And they asked that question.
What question?
And he was, do you feel safe at home?
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting right there. And yeah. I thought, gee, how could anyone say, no, I don't feel safe at home when your husband is right there? So yeah. Anytime someone comes with you, how are they going to, why would they want to ask you that question?
Hearing you say that seems a little mechanical at that point, that they're just asking it because it's on the list. Deb, thanks a lot for that call. Diane Gorgas?
She's point on, and that's the criticism, and that's the reason that we're not seeing significant increase in reporting numbers if it's done in that environment. And to ask a mechanical question for such a personally gut-wrenching social situation is just, frankly, inappropriate. So I agree with Deb 100%.
Just don't bother even asking it at that point.
In that situation, it really, you have to be invested in the issue. And investment in the issue includes being cognizant of patient confidentiality.
You have a lot of limitations because you're an emergency room physician for obvious reasons. Things are changed. Things are different because of electronic records and so forth. And then there's the whole social work system that's associated with healthcare now. And you can refer people to different agencies and that sort of thing. But all things being equal, you're very limited. What is this medical system as a whole? What could it do better? You're sort of hamstrung, but there's other.
Well, I think that as a community, we're hamstrung as well. The federal and state funding for domestic violence resource centers, for women's shelters, they are severely underfunded. Within the medical system, we actually have social workers who have areas of expertise in this. So we can utilize them, but they are limited as well by outpatient resources and ultimate referral. Essentially, even the prosecutor's office in Columbus is hamstrung with the finances that they have, and that there's extremely limited funds for prosecuting domestic violence assailants.
Do you think that primary care physicians should regularly screen? It's a lot of women, they'll see their primary care person, maybe it's their OBGYN or something like that, once a year at least.
It's a great point. And most of the literature on domestic violence comes out of emergency departments, comes out of OBGYN offices, and comes out of family practice offices. There is a movement afoot right now to educate trauma physicians as well as orthopedic surgeons for recognizing patterns of violence and for routinely screening for this. I think the bottom line is anybody that has an established relationship with the patient should be asking about mechanism of injury and safety of the home environment.
If we still have time for a few phone calls, if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Joe who says, please consider referring listeners, healthcare professionals, to the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. There are resources available at the website. It's odvn.org, including Ohio's healthcare protocol on domestic violence. We'll post that link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. There have been a few studies showing that victims of domestic abuse feel more comfortable talking to doctors than to any other professionals. like clergy or an ex, although Pat Wynn Brown was just in here talking about how people will talk to their hairdresser.
Yes.
And I know that that has been an issue before. I've written about that before. But as far as that connection with professionals, these people often are people you've never seen before or met before or, you know, infrequently at best, but they will talk to you sometimes.
Absolutely. And they just need to have that door opened so that they know that I have the time and I have the interest in their life. We're all strapped for time. We're all electronically wired so that we can't unplug or disconnect when we go into a patient's room. But these are the type of situations where I have somebody carry my phone, carry my pager, and I say, you have my undivided attention. Tell me what I can do to help you. Tell me what the problem is. How can we progress forward so that you are in a safe environment? Let me provide you with resources.
And how much do you think just having that conversation helps?
We always remember the cases that are frustrating when you see those patients back again and again,
yeah,
despite having that conversation. And I think that there has to be a perfect alignment of a threshold that the patient reaches, an opportunity to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and somebody within the medical system taking the time to really become invested in their problem. If all of those things align, I really believe that we can make significant interventions, even as emergency physicians, when we only see patients, hopefully, once for something like this. But I have to believe that I can keep trying and make that difference.
And as far as you mentioned earlier, and it's true, men are also abused by their spouse, by their wives, as well as by their husbands. I mean, and partners of any stripe. How much harder is it to talk with men about this, or isn't it? I don't know. Is there more stigma?
I think that there is more stigma associated with it. The times that I've been able to identify an intimate partner abuse pattern and the victim has been a male, they are more willing to talk about it. But my concern is I think it goes largely unrecognized at a greater percentage with men than with women. And our ability to screen for women is notoriously dismal as well.
We just don't seem to be getting that much better at it.
We don't seem to be getting that much better at it. Or even at the touch point where we identify a victim of intimate partner violence, we don't seem to be able to intervene to make a significant change.
You never saw the woman again that you wrote about in your column?
Never did. Sought her out in every possible form.
You did. You tried to find her.
Yeah, absolutely. But keeping in mind that reaching out to patients when they don't want to be found can be a risk for those patients. So I had to do so relatively covertly, just a follow-up phone call saying, I saw the patient and I saw you in the emergency department. Just wondering how you're doing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But being very cognizant that this is one of those classic situations where the impetus for change really does need to come from the patient.
From the victim.
Yes.
Yeah. And going back to Deb's comment, is it unusual for the abuser to be in the room too?
No, it's not at all unusual.
Okay, interesting.
And when... this is classic of all abuse patterns, including elder abuse and child abuse and intimate partner violence, that that these are the bonds that are the toughest to physically separate. When I have a domestic partner in the room that refuses to leave the room at any point during the conversation, warning bells go off in my head.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it. Diane Gorgas, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Anne.
Dr. Diane Gorgas, she's the residency director in the Department of Emergency Medicine at OSU. We'll have a link to her column in the Columbus Dispatch about this case. Go to our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Don't forget to check out All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.